you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Welcome to the Twilight Histories, audio fiction that casts you as the hero. You are about to pass into an alternate universe. It may be strange, fascinating, and perhaps terrifying. To survive, you can't just be a tourist. You must become the people you explore. This is your adventure. Today, you're going to hear a story by Kevin Valbanese called Living Fossil. It's set during the aftermath of the Pacific Theater in World War II, when the Allies were moving in to control areas previously occupied by the Japanese. They discover something truly horrifying. As always, this show was only made possible by the generous contributions of our Patreon community. If you want to become a patron of the Twilight Histories, please visit the website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link to the page. We really appreciate your generous support through Patreon. And now, Living Fossil by Kevin Valbanese.
You swat at the cloud of mosquitoes which hangs above your boat like a vengeful specter on All Hallows' Eve. The miniature demons have pursued you since you departed Semarang, patiently circling just out of arm's reach before diving at your exposed necks and forearms. And you've killed more than you can count, but they just keep coming. And if there's one thing you'll be sure to complain about upon returning to your own timeline, it'll be the preponderance of bloodsuckers in what you'd hoped would be a cruise through the waning days of World War II. Still, in between those infuriating pricks, you at least have a moment to enjoy the warmth of the sun as it shines over the blue-green waters of the Java Sea. And the salty breeze rushes over your skin like a lover's caress, strong enough to soothe what the bugs besiege, but not so forceful as to disturb the waters below. If it wasn't for the airborne vermin, you might think you were on the beaches of Tanjung. Instead, you're crammed on a beat-up old Higgins boat on loan to the Dutch Navy from the Americans. All around you, men of the Corps Marinière swat at the mosquitoes or struggle to light their cigarettes as the Javanese breeze blows through. You've spent the last few weeks in the company of these Nederlanders, doing little more than parading around the territories liberated from Japanese control, reminding the locals that these are still the Dutch East Indies. The presence of these European extracts along the coasts and in the humid jungles of Sumatra has been ill-received, to put it lightly. Even now, the handful of locals accompanying your squad make no attempt to hide their discontent. Indifferent to the mosquitoes, but visibly disgusted with you and your compatriots. You have no doubt that these swarthy fellows would hurl you all into the sea if they weren't outnumbered, and if the Mausers and Tommy guns that you kept on hand weren't providing an extra measure of insurance. Still, for the time being, the hope is that the Dutch and the locals of the East Indies will reach some sort of accord after years of brutal fighting against the forces of Imperial Japan. Everything should be back to normal, you recall hearing at your base back in Semarang. And, at least for now, your tenuous accord is holding as you all set about the work ahead. In fact, you can see it now, just over the edge of the landing. Floating alone, silent and aimless, the MS Izumo awaits. The large cargo vessel, nearly 400 feet long, drifts alone in the open waters, apparently heading west, though at negligible speed. Tensions rise as your fellow mariniers ready their weapons, expecting to be fired upon as you approach portside. But you come right up to the ship without any trouble. Not a soul peers over the side of the ship, and nobody answers when one of the locals, Rama, calls out in fluent Japanese. Back at the base, you've been told that several attempts were made to contact the crew using telegraph ciphers obtained from the captured Japanese generals, and that warning shots had even been fired as the ship approached from the Flores Sea. But the ship continued to drift on, its course charted apparently by the currents. One attempt had been made to board the ship previously, but the weather turned and forced the Americans making the attempt to retreat to shore. And so it was that the British and Americans passed the buck to the token Dutch forces in the area the moment something else came up. The orders were simple: collect anything of value, report on anything suspicious, and commandeer the ship if possible for redeployment in Indochina. You wonder what might have happened to the crew, and you remain on edge as Rama and another one of the locals, Hassan, hurl grappling hooks up and over the ship's railing. You half expect the Japanese to start firing from above, but the two locals clamber up the side of the ship without meeting any resistance. And it's only a moment later when they hurl a rope ladder down from the deck and signal that it's all clear to come up. Something seems off, but you can't be sure what. Perhaps, morbid as it may be, the simple answer is that the crew took their own lives. Japan has been on its last legs for a few weeks now, with several of its cities razed to the ground, and the Japanese have proven themselves dedicated to the bitter end. The Americans cursed openly about ships lost to the kamikaze fighters, and even here in the East Indies, capturing Japanese holdouts has proven difficult, with entire units vanishing into the jungles and refusing to surrender until the last man or two. Perhaps that dedication extends even to the crews of cargo ships, and they saw fit to die by their own hands rather than surrender to Allied forces. The possibility of a grim discovery is small, but the odds seem to increase as you pull yourself up and onto the ship, and catch a faint but unpleasant smell wafting in the air. You prepare yourself for a very different welcome from the crew as you draw your Mauser and join two other Marines, Henrik Peters and Erik Spans, in searching the starboard side of the ship. Rama and Hassan stay behind to help the rest of your squad up, and another two Marines, Graf and Visser, begin to search portside. You enter the crew accommodations, gun leveled and pointed down the dim and rust-ridden corridors. But the moment you open the door, you're hit by an unbearable stench. Something far worse and fishier than the odor released by the famed corpse flowers of Sumatra. You recoil, clamping your arm across your face and squinting hard as the noxious air causes your eyes to water. Peters and Spans likewise retreat from the stench, rushing back onto the deck just in time for Spans to empty his stomach over the starboard side railing. Rama and Hassan run over to inspect the commotion, and they too catch a whiff of the stench, joining Spans at the railing to heave up. You rush over and seal the door shut, not that it does much to lessen the oppressive odor still lingering in the air. Not content to wait, you all retreat further down the deck, and, taking a moment, you tear at your khaki shirts and trousers, ripping away just enough material to tie over your faces. Well, I don't think they're alive in there. Nobody could stay down there for that long without coming up for air, at least. Your observation is met with anxious nods, but nobody is ready to holster their weapons just yet. I guess we just take a deep breath and we try this again. Nobody looks enthusiastic, but you're all supposed to be soldiers here, and so you waste no time returning to the accommodation's door. You make sure your impromptu mask is tight across your face before heaving the door open and leaping inside. You crouch down, your weapon ready. The stench of death is nearly overpowering, and even though you're doing your best to conserve your breath by signaling to Spawns and Peters, the stinging sensation in your eyes is hard to endure. Without a doubt, your advance through the crew quarters is sloppy, hastened by the agony in your lungs and the rancid fumes wafting through the air. You hurl doors open, pointing your pistol this way and that in fear of whoever might be mad enough to conceal themselves in this noxious hell. But as you burst into room after room, you find that there's not a soul in sight. And by the time you and the others are retreating outside again, it's obvious that neither Spawns nor Peters have seen anything or anyone either. If they're in there, they're definitely dead, says Peters. No one could survive in those conditions for so long. I didn't see any bodies, Spann says as he looks to you and Peters for confirmation. You both shake your heads. No. I'm not mad, am I? If they killed themselves, there should be remains. To be fair, we didn't check every room on the level. There's at least two or three levels in either direction to explore, up and down, from what I can see. With that unfortunate point made, you rip even more fabric from your shirt and roll it up into small balls, shoving them up your nostrils until they are secure. Then you tie your impromptu mask back over your face. Spawns and Peters follow your lead, and after everyone takes one last breath of fresh air, you head back inside, signaling to Rama and Hassan to wait a little longer. The two locals look on without pity, simply nodding as you plunge back into the bowels of the ship. You have half a mind to stick a gun in their hands and tell them to follow. But several from within your squad have cautioned against trusting the locals too much. A few years on, they definitely hate the Japanese. But it shouldn't be forgotten that many in the East Indies welcomed the Japanese as liberators. But as far as you're concerned, so long as they don't close the doors on you, there won't be any issues. Moving together with Peters and Spawns, you survey the rooms once more on your way to the final room at the end of the corridor. You hadn't really noticed before in your haste, but the crew's quarters are in absolute disarray. Clothes, empty cans, and the odd shell casing litter the floor. It looks like there was a desperate scramble everywhere you go. Cots are overturned, and in a few rooms, you spy dents in the walls where a bullet must have struck. You wonder if the crew turned on each other. Had some order to commit suicide come down, and a reluctant few fought back? If that was the case, then where are the bodies of those who fell in the struggle? If they'd been tossed overboard, the stench wouldn't be as bad as it is now. And what about blood? For all the shots that appear to have missed and struck the wall, there's not a splash of blood in sight. Did the suicidal crew clean that up before then killing themselves? It doesn't make any sense. You begin to fear that the answer to all your questions awaits in the room at the end of the corridor. You approach it, pistol leveled, as Spawns and Peters flank the door on either side. You brace yourself, expecting to find the crew piled up inside. Taking a beat, you ignore several prompts from Peters and Spawns. Composure is key here, yes, but there's no way to truly prepare yourself for what might await behind that door. You are only a tourist in this land, after all. You didn't fight in any of the battles against the Japanese, and you've yet to even fire a weapon. Death is still an alien concept to you, despite your obsession with the wartime era. But now, you're confronted with the human cost. The dread of whatever awaits behind that door smothers you and penetrates deep into your body, far more effectively than the wretched fumes ever could. Finally, when you can ignore the pleading eyes of your colleagues no longer, you grab the door latch and fling it open. Then, pistol first, you rush into the dim room, your mind already conjuring the worst visions of hell. You had expected a mound of the dead, or perhaps a row of neatly arranged cots, each occupied by the corpse of a sailor. Somewhere in the back of your mind, you even thought you would find the enemy gasping their last as they expired from exposure to the noxious atmosphere. You had conjured many horrors in your mind, but the scene that confronts you now defies the imagination. There are no bodies to be found in the last room, but it's not as if the scene is peaceful either. The floor is covered with a mysterious goop, a thick slime several inches deep, and the monotony of its surface is only disturbed by the odd rotting fish. Fish heads, tails, and whatever else putrefy in this alien residue. Everything in the room is covered with this stuff, including several toppled bunks, a desk, and several blades and pistols, the tips of which peer out from under the slime. There had been a struggle. Of this, there could be no doubt. The crew had fought here, perhaps a last stand, and the enemy, it seems, had made quick work of them. And if you were wondering what happened to the crew, you had a semblance of an answer there, too. The attack, it seems, came from within the ship itself. A wide, gaping hole confronts you from across the room, emerging from where the floor meets the inner wall. A heavyset man could easily squeeze through the hole, though it would be a perilous task, given the twisting and jagged metal lining the mouth of the hole, dripping with slime. The existence of this hole presents yet another mystery, for you had been told that no Allied ship had fired upon the Izumo. Nothing but a shell could penetrate through the metal with such explosive force, and yet the exterior of the ship was without blemish. An explosion from within might have done the trick, but then, shouldn't the crew be lying here, in pieces or otherwise? And why the fish? You have a feeling that the answer, or at least the beginnings of one, lay at the bottom of that hole. And despite your better nature, you inch forward, stepping into the slime and drawing nearer to the void and its razor edges. You try to peer down into the nether reaches of the ship, past the dripping slime, but it's hard to see anything from your present angle. You draw nearer, mindful not to slip, and find yourself impaled on the torn metal. And then, from down in the ship's hull, you hear something. A faint rumbling echoes out from the hole, and then you hear a disgusting slopping and sloshing sound. At the same time, you think of a stomach groaning in agony, a fish flopping about, and a snake slithering over muddy ground. Whatever it is, the sloshing, slopping cacophony touches something primal in you, and it sends you slipping and sliding as you retreat from the room, slamming the door shut behind you and signaling for Peters and Spawns to run. You slip, thanks to the residue on your boots, but Spawns heaves you up and leads you back out onto the deck. You slam the door shut behind you and crumple over, trying to catch your breath and make sense of whatever it was you just heard. You cough and retch from behind your mask, struggling to catch your breath and orient yourself. Your fists crack against either side of your head as you try to excise that slopping sound from your mind. "Get yourself together," shouts Peters. You hear some water dripping in the pipes and you run like a toddler? Peters seizes you by the collar and heaves you up, giving you a good slap across the face, dislodging your mask and filling your nostrils with the lingering stench from inside. "The sooner we're done with this grim business, the sooner we can enjoy a beer on the beach." Peters holds up his Tommy gun and smacks the drum. "Now get moving. I'll lead things from here." You fix your mask and try to compose yourself. His words might be harsh, but Peters is right. You let a flight of fancy send you off the edge, and while you do think something suspicious happened to the crew, you can't jump to any wild conclusions. Accidents happen, mutinies take place, and there's still a chance that the crew decided to part with this life before they would ever be forced to tread under the Allied yoke. "I'm sorry, Peters, but maybe we should regroup with everyone else before we head down." After a beat, Peters nods, then looks around. He leers and then walks over to the open part of the deck, searching. "Peters? Where is everyone?" There's not a trace of Rama or Hassan anywhere. You all call out to them, but there's not a sound beyond the gentle lapping of the waves. Come to think of it, with all the commotion earlier, you're surprised that Visser and Graf hadn't come running either. You decide to check on the Higgins boat, rushing over to where you boarded the ship, and you are shocked to find it missing.
"They left us,"
shouts Spahns as he gestures out to the water. You spy the Higgins boat speeding away, your fellow soldiers and the other locals staring at you, making no effort to turn back.
"Why would they do that?"
You have a guess. A large dent juts out from the side of the ship near the bottom of your rope ladders, right where the Higgins had been. Someone, or something, had nearly burst out the side of the ship, and the startled crew had likely fled without a second thought. And clearly, they were spooked enough that they were making no attempt to rescue you from the apparent danger. In that moment, your heart sinks in your chest. "Bastards," curses Peters. "We're going below deck. And God help me if I find one of those Japanese devils hiding down there. They'd better know how to steer this ship, or I'm going to toss them overboard." Without another word, Peters signals for you to get going. And when you hesitate, he looks ready to take aim and unload on you. So you hustle along rather than reason with a desperate man. You can't even offer a word of caution before Peters flings open the door to the ship's interior and rushes in, his Tommy gun leveled. He takes no caution and openly grunts and coughs as he combats the noxious air. If the Japanese are down there, if they hadn't already, they'll definitely hear him coming now. And you have no choice but to follow him as he rushes past the crew quarters and heads for a staircase leading to the lower reaches of the ship. You pass the slime-covered room again on your way to the staircase, and for a beat, you eye the door, pondering the hole from which that haunting, slithering sound had emerged. You don't know if your mind is playing tricks on you, but for a moment, you think you hear something gurgling or slopping around just behind the door. But you dare not open it, hand, Spahn's pulls you away before you can fall too far behind the rapidly descending Peters. You head down the cramped staircase, entering a shadowy and smothering realm as the sun's rays can no longer reach you, and the dying bulbs dangling from the ceiling barely grant sight beyond a few feet. Every step becomes more perilous as the cold and rust-ridden steps are covered by slime dripping from cracks and holes in the ceiling. You can feel the wretched fluid drip down onto your shoulders, startling you as if you might turn and find the jaws of some creature from hell agape and ready to swallow you whole. You're starting to think that the devil himself had loosed his hellhounds on the unfortunate crew of the ship. For everywhere you go, you find no trace of the Japanese, save for discarded weapons. Kicking in every door from this point on, you find rooms either completely dry and too cramped to conceal more than a man or two, or you find large chambers and rooms drenched in slime and equally devoid of life. Someone or something had gotten here first and dispatched them all. There's simply no other conclusion. Clearing this level, you regroup with Peters as he orders you down the staircase again, descending into what is likely the deepest reaches of the ship. Making progress is brutal as the atmosphere almost congeals and the biting stench causes your skin to tingle and maybe even burn. You can't choke back a cough, and soon you're wheezing and stumbling as you descend the steps. It suddenly occurs to you that perhaps the Japanese had been conveying some manner of chemical weapon, and that a leak may have poisoned them all and left behind the residue that spreads over everything like a festering mold. It's suddenly feasible that the sailors had been driven mad by the fumes, and perhaps after an initial struggle in their quarters, they had, one by one, hurled themselves into the sea to escape the madness. You reach out to grab Peters and signal for him to go, fearful of shouting in what may be toxic air. Every breath at this point is precious. After all, rotten flesh is one thing, but a potential nerve agent is another. But before you can snatch the back of his shirt, Peters bursts open yet another door and jams the barrel of his gun into the void, asserting his dominance to what is likely another empty room. Slipping on the endemic slime, you crash into Peters, causing him to fumble with his gun. He turns to rebuke you, slamming you against the doorway. You hurl your hands up, trying to signal that you need to go, but it's all nonsense to Peters. "Just say it, won't you? You have a tongue in that thick skull of yours." You're about to tell Peters what he needs to hear, when suddenly, your eyes catch the glint of something in the room. This chamber is larger than the rest, likely the Izumo's cargo hold. But instead of crates overflowing with ammunition, rations, or even barrels of toxic chemicals, you find the room filled with tanks of water. Upon closer inspection, you realize that these aren't just tanks of water. They're fish tanks, and the cargo hold cradled in the belly of the Izumo are the makings of an aquarium. Or at least, they would have been if the residents of those tanks were still swimming around. From what you can see, all the fish are either gone, or chunks of them are floating in the water. And as your eyes adjust to the dim room, you cast your gaze around, scrutinizing the strange setup even further. While you could chalk up the empty aquariums to the starvation of a hungry crew, the contents of the slime-flooded floor leave you speechless and clinging to the edges of sanity. Floating on the surface of that wretched sludge are bones. far larger than any fish might leave behind. Dozens, no, hundreds of bones float aimlessly about, all mixed up in a way that would make identifying the number or character of the dead impossible. A sea, white, picked clean of any trace of flesh, ebbs and flows as the Izumo drifts on the gentle Javanese waves. In that moment, you are certain you've gone mad. But then, the ghost ship offers up one more glimpse from beyond the veil of the macabre. A great gurgling resounds throughout the cargo hold, drawing your attention to a massive central tank. Unlike all the others, the water within is black and thick with the slime that spills out from over the edge. The tank is large enough to hold a small whale, though without any room for the cetacean to move freely. And yet, the resident of the tank proves far larger and more terrifying than the kraken-slaying leviathans of the deep. Its head breaches the surface, rearing up like a king cobra about to strike. The thing is black as the deepest reaches of the sea, its white, milky eyes pulsing and oozing as the bottom dweller exposes itself to the dim light of the cargo hold. Its long, gilled, gelatinous neck terminates in a bony skull, armed with comically large jaws. The long, sharp fangs jut out from the creature's jawline in every direction, some even bursting through the lower lip, while others emerge from the roof of the serpent's mouth. The beast looks like it was plucked from the most feverish dreams of a deep-sea diver, and it towers over you like the Hydra before Hercules, letting the now familiar slime drip from between its rows of malformed teeth onto the floor in front of you. Some primal urge takes you all over, and in an instant, you, Spawns, and Peters all open fire, unloading everything you have into the beast until your magazines all run dry. The beast reels about, oozing slime from the dozens of bullet holes that riddle its long neck. And then, it falls backward into the tank, disappearing into the inky water. But you have not a moment to celebrate, as the water begins to froth and surge about as five massive bulks emerge from under its surface. And then they are joined in another instant by three more slightly malformed heads. In defiance of all the laws of nature, the many heads stretch out, elongating their necks and discharging a torrent of slime from the tears in their gelatinous flesh. The water from the tank spills over as the beast grows larger and larger, exposing its midsection, revealing that the many heads and necks all belong to one body. The Japanese, it seems, were indeed ferrying a weapon into these waters. A horror doubtless dredged up from the blackest, most remote reaches of the ocean depths. They had caught a dragon and sought to keep it contained, but the hunger of this eldritch sea spawn could not be satiated, and it devoured them all, caring not for the flag that its captors waved. Indeed, as the beast's many heads converge on your position, you know in your heart that you will all end up as just another jumble of bones, like the crew, probably like your colleagues. God knows who else. But you are standing in the doorway, and while the beast can doubtless burst through iron, you have a chance. And a chance is all you need. You have no time to inform Peters of your desperate plan. And so, as the gaping maws of the beast open wide, and its necks coil back in preparation for a strike, you simply turn and run, flinging the door closed behind you. Passing shell-shocked spawns, you run for dear life, and you hear wet flesh crashing against the cold metal. You slip and slide, praying for dear life that you do not stumble before you reach the stairs. If you can just make it onto the deck, there is a chance. It's not much, and as you hear the door crashing down in the corridor behind you, the odds get slimmer and slimmer with every passing moment. But damn it, you have to try. You'll die trying, if you have to.
That was Living Fossil by Kevin Valbanese. If you're a fan of the Twilight Histories, consider making it official by becoming a patron of the show. When you join us on Patreon, you'll get instant access to tons of Twilight History shows not available to the public, such as bonus shows that expand on some of the worlds you explore in these stories, and you'll even get an entire secret podcast I created but never launched called The Dark Histories. If you stick around as our patron for 3 months, we'll send you amazing merchandise as a reward, such as Twilight Histories mugs, shirts, stickers, or a hoodie. But really, the real reason to support us is that you love the Twilight Histories and you want to see us grow. You support your favorite craft brewery because you love their beer and you want to see their company succeed. Well, the Twilight Histories is a craft podcast, and we need your help and support to keep us growing. To join, go to the website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link to our Patreon page. Or go directly to Patreon and look us up. We're the Twilight Histories. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Till next time, take care.